Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Do we have Linda Siegel on the phone by any chance?
I'm here, Mary Charlotte. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Linda Siegel is KSFR's legislative correspondent, and we are delighted to have her here. We do the legislative update on Tuesdays and Thursdays during the legislative session. What is happening in the legislature? I guess there's quite a bit about education.
Well, yes, Mary Charlotte, and of course there's a lot about budget, and that comes into education. It seems that this year we have a lot less money to work with than we have in the past, whereas last year there was about $600 million new recurring dollars. This year there's only about $368, and the entities that suffer, of course, when there's not a lot of money are education and health care and those areas. So this session, so far, the House has already made some suggestions for education budget, and they're looking at only 2% raises for our teachers and instructional support people. So it's not looking so good.
Just out of curiosity, who is it that doesn't suffer when there's less money?
Well, that's a good point. All of us, I think.
So, Linda Siegel, what is actually happening right now? Are there laws being passed? What is being debated?
Well, one of the hot issues in education this year is what's called the funding formula. Now, we've had a very sophisticated and complicated funding formula in New Mexico that has lots of factors and add-ons for all different kinds of things like bilingual education and music and PE and health care providers. And what this group that's been working 2 years on it has decided is that we need to make the funding formula much more simple, and we need to give the public schools more money. So there's a very important bill, the funding formula bill, which just passed out of the House Education Committee yesterday. But it's very controversial, and the big problem is there's no way to fund it.
Well, that would make a funding formula bill a little bit problematic. What if,
yes,
what if they stuck with the old formula? Is there a way to fund that?
Well, as I said, there's not much increase this year, even with the old formula. So what may happen is they may pass this new funding formula, which needs almost $400 million new dollars. They may go ahead and pass it and then make it go into effect in a date in the future.
Well, Linda Siegel, we look forward to hearing about more this coming Thursday and every Tuesday and Thursday during the term of the legislative session. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And Linda Siegel is KSFR's legislative correspondent. I'd like now to welcome, joining us here in the Baking Company, Jean-Philippe Malaty. He is the executive director of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. Welcome.
Good morning.
So you are out of Aspen and back in Santa Fe to do performances at the Lensic this Friday and Saturday.
Yes, back in Santa Fe, and we're kicking out our winter season. These two performances are going to be the beginning of a long touring season for us.
Now, this is a very interesting program because there are four pieces and three of them are premieres.
Yes, we're very excited about that. The company has been very committed in discovering new choreographers and bringing new work, and that's really the focus of what we do. The Nutcracker is behind us now. The holiday season is past, and we're doing a program that is a little bit more contemporary, a little more edgy, with new upcoming choreographers and also one very established.
Who is the established choreographer?
William Forsythe.
Okay.
William Forsythe is an American choreographer who had all of his career in Frankfurt, in Germany, and really revolutionized dance. I think he's probably the next one after Balanchine to have really taken dance to the next level.
What do you mean by that? I mean, I know we're on the radio and we can't show it visually, but what does that mean?
He pushed the bodies in the different ways. He molded the bodies in a way that they've never moved before. Balanchine was very much everything in balance. William Forsythe is known for taking the bodies out of balance and almost always, you know, falling, playing with the counterbalance and the weight. And that is now, you know, something that is almost standard in every, you know, choreographer's style or repertoire. But he was really the instigator of this style.
So the piece that he's doing is Slingerland. Is that correct?
Yes, it's a duet. It's a pas de deux for two people. It's on point, which is unusual, usually, you know, for more modern choreography. And it's a beautiful, beautiful duet. We're very proud to have added this in our repertoire. It's not easy to acquire a work by William Forsythe for many reasons, some financial one, and also he needs to approve the level of the company in order to allow his work to be performed.
Can't blame the guy.
No, you can't.
Now, it's interesting. The Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, it's a ballet. It's not Aspen Santa Fe modern dance, so you do dance on point. But how much do you practice point as opposed to other styles of other kinds of shoes on the women's feet?
That's a great question, Marshall. Thank you for asking that, because we get that from the audience very, very often. And there's a little bit of a misunderstanding of the word ballet in America. People assume that ballet is classical ballet. People assume that it is Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, and it's on point, and the girls have tutus. We use the word ballet on a more generic sense, very much like a company of dance, like a troupe, like a group. There are, you know, many ballet companies who do not perform ballet at all. There's a Ballet Folklorico of Mexico,
right,
for instance.
So well, I mean, ballet, the word, it means simply to dance.
And that's the way we use it in our, you know, our name, Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. Now, so that being said, all the dancers are classically trained. We obviously did Nutcracker last month. Every morning the company has a very rigorous, very traditional ballet class. All our ladies are capable of going on point, even though our repertoire, what we do in the evening, might be a little more contemporary.
Well, that's what I mean. They're capable of doing it, but do they practice it as much as you might in the New York City Ballet?
Yes, I would say so, because, you know, every morning the class is you know, classically based. The work that we do on stage is still on point. So, but, you know, ballet is an evolving art form. You know, it's like music or even art. It's always changing, and we don't really want to be a museum. We're not interested in showcasing all work or all technique. We want to move forward and see what's next.
And so the way you do that is not by choreographing your own work, but by working with some of the most interesting choreographers all around the world.
Yeah, that's really our interest. First of all, Tom Mossbrook, artistic director, myself, I have really no desire in choreographing or no talent, as a matter of fact. So we rather really collect masterpieces from many different choreographers. We feel it's a more interesting showcase for the audience. We know for sure that it's a much more interesting and challenging career for the dancers. They get to experience many different styles, work with many different people, and really be part of the process. And we feel that it's a more interesting, you know, evening to see, you know, different works by different people.
So let's talk about the other three works, the premieres that are happening this weekend at the Lenzic.
Two commission work. That's also a big focus of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. We do commission new choreographers or up-and-coming choreographers to create work. It is very important for us to discover the next generation. We're showcasing two of those young choreographers in our program. One ballet called Time is Running Out by Edouard Liang. Edouard Liang was a former dancer with the New York City Ballet. So again, from the, you know, more traditional classical background. And this is his third work for the ballet company. Also a duet, music by Ravel. So again, more on the classical side. And then something very interesting, Helen Pickett. Helen Pickett is obviously a female choreographer, which, just aside, is a rare species.
I wonder why.
We all wonder why, Mary Charlotte. It's very interesting because the dance world is really dominated by females. I mean, in ballet company, on stage, you know, we had an audition in New York a couple of weeks ago to recruit new dancers. Out of, you know, 100 dancers, we had 80 girls and, you know, maybe 20 guys. So really, as a dancer, it's really dominated by female. And then when the careers are over and we go into choreographing, it's really dominated by male. And
Nobody knows why. Isn't that interesting? Because a lot of former dancers become choreographers.
Usually that's, you know, the traditional path. You need to have experimented for yourself and, you know, move yourself to be able to create on other people. So we don't really know, but, you know, it will be very difficult for most people, you know, in the cafe today to... name, you know, a female choreographer. They might know Martha Graham, but
right, and Twyla Tharp.
And Twyla Tharp, but then that will stop there. So Helen Pickett grew up in San Francisco, danced with the San Francisco Ballet, and then pure coincidence was a dancer for many years for William Forsythe in Frankfurt.
Ah.
They just happened to be on the same program. It was not really, you know, intentional. And so she experienced firsthand the change of style and the, you know, the advancement of dance by working with William Forsythe. And now she's taking that knowledge and trying to move it up forward herself.
So what is her choreography like?
Very interesting, because it's a very positive, light, entertaining, bright ballet, which usually... we tend now with more contemporary work that reflects in our generation or our era or time or economics or what's going on in the world. Those works tend to be a little bit heavy and darker. And so we were so happy when she came and, you know, brought some great music by two famous composers. One is Philip Glass, of course, everybody knows. The other one, Thomas Newman. Classical-based, you know, music as well. And she decided to use the female dancers on point, which instantly makes it, you know, very feminine.
Very interesting. And so, let's see, and there's one more.
And there's one more, that's a repeat by Jorma Elo. We performed this ballet this summer. It was a great success. Jorma Elo is from Finland. So you see, on that program, we're getting really, you know, American choreographer, another one from Finland. Dance could happen all over the world. It's a ballet that was created for the Netherlands Dance Theater, and we are only the second company of having this in the repertoire. It's called First Flash.
So it's practically a premiere.
Almost. Well, we perform it this summer.
Yeah.
And the music is by Sibelius.
So this it's very interesting because in dance companies where the choreography is done in-house, there's not necessarily the impetus to go and see what's going on in the rest of the world. That's what you do. You have to, I mean, how do you do it? How do you figure out what's happening in Finland and these other places?
Well, that's our job, and also, you know, maybe a little more from Tom Mosbrucker, who's our artistic director. The dance world is a small world. So it's very spread out, but it is, you know, a very small compared to maybe other, you know, industries or art form. And it is our job to talk to other directors, our colleagues, other dance company. We scout out, you know, programming and what's going on in London, what's going on in Europe. Unfortunately, we do not have the budget to, you know, fly all over the place to see choreographers. But nowadays with the technology and, you know, DVDs and email and, you know, we're able to scout out choreographers and they will send us their material. Also, the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet has really developed a great reputation for new work and discovering the next choreographers. For instance, we have many works by Nicolo Fonte. We were the first company to bring Nicolo from Spain to choreograph for the company. Since then, he's choreographed work for every major ballet company in the world, from the Royal Ballet of Flanders, the Australian Ballet, Pacific Northwest Ballet, you name it, you know, he's done work for all the companies. So young choreographers know that the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet is looking for them, and they usually send us material or video or invite us to go and see a performance.
One thing that's changed in dance is the way dancers rehearse and also the way their bodies are. They're not necessarily the willowy little twigs that they were 30, 40 years ago.
You're right. Great observation. Again, the technique has changed. You know, they are the bodies are pushed much more to the limit. It's becoming much more athletic. It's very demanding. You cannot really sustain, you know, a career or even a season, you know, or not being fit or, you know, healthy, as a matter of fact.
I think they don't smoke so much anymore either.
No, we have no dancers. We have 10 dancers in the company, and we are very proud to say that none of them smoke. So they're becoming very more, you know, conscious of being an athlete rather than maybe being a performer. So that has changed a lot, I would say, you know, in the last 10 years maybe.
How do you choose the dancers for your company? There's so many wonderful, incredible dancers out there, but is there some specific sort of spirit or way of moving that you're looking for?
Great. Well, you're asking great questions. Thank you so much. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was in New York City and did an audition. As I mentioned earlier, we had about 100 people show up, 80 women, 20 men. And the audition lasts about 2 hours, and it's in the form of a class. They take a ballet class, a very standard, very basic, very classical. And I have about an hour and a half to find out who could be suitable for the company. And we are very fortunate due to the fact that very few of our dancers leave. So for us, it's a rare occasion to have to fill a contract or a position. For instance, this year, we were not really looking for anybody, but you never know who's going to be out there. So you need to be present. You need to look. Usually the process lasts maybe a couple of years. We like somebody. We bring them to Aspen or we bring them to Santa Fe. We let them work with the company. Being a very small company of only 5 women and 5 men, the chemistry of the group for us is what's most important. A dancer is our job. We could retrain them or train them, or we could teach them the style of our company. We could make them better dancers. We feel that's something that we have the tool, you know, to change. Personality, charisma on stage, personality, spirit, that's something we really cannot change. So that's really what we're looking for. And it's very funny because, you know, when I was a dancer myself, I went to many of those auditions. We call them cattle call. And, you know, you're in the room with 100 people and you say, oh, you know, there's no way they could have seen me. And now, being on the other side of the fence, I did tell the dancers at the beginning of the class, I say, you know, I used to think exactly the same way you're thinking, but believe me, with the experience now and being on the other side and really knowing our company and knowing what we're looking for, I could find, you know, a dancer in the haystack if I had to.
Because there's some invisible or visible but hard to define thing that just stands out.
Yes. And then usually we look at the dancers, but we really look we look at the personality or the spirit of the person before the technique, for sure.
We're talking to Jean-Philippe Malaty, who is with the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet Company. So you are doing these pieces Friday and Saturday night at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The number over there, by the way, is 988-1234 here in Santa Fe. Then you tour to other places.
Yes, really. A question that I get all the time, Marichal, is like, well, do you perform more in Santa Fe? Do you perform more in Aspen? The company having a dual base. And really the answer nowadays is like, we perform more elsewhere. The company has become very popular in the theater world, and we're invited to perform all over the place. Right after Santa Fe, we're going to head our way back to Colorado, perform in Aspen, and then we're going to tour almost until the end of March nonstop. Those venues will include Wichita, Kansas, Livermore, California, Dallas. We're returning to Dallas. We're making our debut to New Orleans for the first time. We're very excited.
New Orleans, wow.
So the company really travels, and we're proud of being ambassador for the city of Aspen and Santa Fe and show them that we also have great dance in the Southwest.
And so you're based in... Why are you based... We've talked about this before on the radio, but remind us why you are based in the two most expensive real estate cities in the West.
Serendipity, for sure. The company started in Aspen, Colorado. It was the vision of our founder, Bibi Shwepi, who wanted to have a ballet company in Aspen. As you know, we have already a great music festival, great skiing, great restaurants, and she thought that a ballet company was missing. So a few years later, about 5 years later, we were approached by a group of individuals here in Santa Fe who wanted the same thing for the city of Santa Fe, who wanted to have a permanent school, who wanted to have a company that will perform here regularly and wanted to have, you know, dancers and dancers created here in Santa Fe. And so we decided, since we were two very small towns with a lot of differences but a lot of similarities as well, we decided to collaborate and join forces, if you like, to support one great dance company. As you know, it is extensive to produce art. It is especially for dance. It's very time-consuming. The creative process is very long and usually costly. And it was really a great marriage of two cities coming together to support a company, which is a format that is really unique today.
Well, the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet Company is in Santa Fe this Friday and Saturday at the Lenzic Theater. 4 pieces, 3 of them never seen before. Jean-Philippe Malaty, Executive Director of the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet Company, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having us.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we will be talking about Leonard Peltier. Stay tuned to KSFR. And I would like to welcome now Harvey Arden. Harvey Arden is a journalist who wrote for National Geographic for 23 years, and he's the author of several books, including Wisdom Keepers, Meetings with Native American Spiritual Elders, Dream Keepers, A Spirit Journey into Aboriginal Australia, and Have You Thought About Leonard Peltier Lately? He's also the editor of the book Prison Writings, My Life is a Sundance by Leonard Peltier, and he will be doing events in Santa Fe this Thursday and Saturday along with guest performers, and we'll talk about that more in just a few minutes. Welcome. Welcome, Harvey. It's wonderful to have you here.
Oh, it's nice to be in Santa Fe, and for Santa Fe, I have a personal warm welcome from Leonard Peltier, who I talked to just a week ago today. On Tuesday, he called me. Well, I live in Washington. He can only talk for 10 minutes a day, and so hello, Santa Fe, with a big warm hug from Leonard Peltier.
There are some people listening to this broadcast who don't know who Leonard Peltier is, so why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Leonard Peltier is a Native American man who many times in his life, but particularly in an event in June 1975, he stood up for his people against a wave of killings and beatings of elders, and he's paid for that now.
Having been
absolutely falsely convicted by the FBI.
So he was accused of
the murder of two FBI agents on a farm on the Pine Ridge Reservation on June 26, 1975. Leonard killed nobody. Most of the people in the world who have ever studied this would realize and agree that Leonard isn't innocent. His great crime was being innocent. He went into, after a bunch of phony trials, into federal prison when he was 31. He's now 63. There is a formal parole hearing for him in December of this year, 2008, where criminals who are might be pardoned on such a date or let loose with executive clemency. Unfortunately, Mr. Bush will still be, I presume, in power at that time. And it's unlikely that he will be released at that time. Then his next parole hearing is in 2017. His official release date would be 2041.
Now, I don't want to go into the details of the various court cases and hearings and so on, but I think it's safe to say that people who have examined this case closely, including the government itself, have really seen that Leonard Peltier's innocence has been demonstrated, and he did not kill these FBI agents.
No
Why
question.
Is he still in prison? Excuse the Pollyanna nature
of
the question.
Well, look at it this way. His crime was innocence. Crimes were committed, grave crimes. Hundreds
these
of
two people died, and a lot of other people died.
By various accounts, at least 65, if not a few hundred people, were murdered by a corrupt tribal council that sent out people called goons, guardians of the Oglala Nation, to terrorize the territory on behalf of the energy companies who wanted the uranium underneath Pine Ridge. And in fact, on the very weekend where Leonard was in a gunfight that got him into all this trouble, that tribal chief was in Washington signing away control of one-eighth of the Pine Ridge Reservation. The Pine Ridge Reservation is huge.
For mineral rights?
The government, on behalf of these same energy interests, wanted the uranium. They wanted to get at that uranium that was under there. At that time, uranium was high. Everybody wanted it. Very shortly after that, the price of uranium collapsed. Nobody had to make atomic bombs anymore for a while there. And it's still low, the price of uranium. It's probably going up again. In any case, it was uranium they wanted. As Leonard himself has often said, I'm a victim of the energy wars. And so are you, my friend. And so was your children. The very same people who now seem to have such tremendous control in this country are the very same people who put Leonard away and found out that the best way to imprison somebody is to find somebody who's innocent. The guilty have all sorts of lies and strategies, but the innocent can't say anything, but I didn't do it. And they love that.
What actually happened to the land that was signed away? Did they start extracting uranium from it?
No, they never did. As I say, the market collapsed, the need for it collapsed. There's some thought now that we will have to face their aggression again. But I think the main part of it is called the Gunnery Range, the Sheep Ridge, I think it is, Gunnery Range. There's even negotiations for returning it to the tribe.
Now, you are a journalist. You worked with National Geographic for 23 years. How did you get involved with Leonard Peltier?
Well, it started at National Geographic in a way, and Steve Wall, a wonderful photographer, put in a suggestion for a story on what we termed at that time some kind of medicine man story. It's pretty standard Geographic stuff. It's always interesting, and I knew beans about Indians. And they okayed that story. Okay, go out and do a nice medicine man story. Go to a bunch of reses and bring us back what they in pictures.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., yeah. And we went out, but as we got to know the people a little better, there was something that they called an elder. In effect, a spiritual elder, a person who wasn't just old, but was actually revered by their tribes. And we eventually came up with the word for that, because there was no word in English for them that I know of, other than medicine man, which is a very misleading term. And it has to do much more than medicine. And one day, inspired, I came up with the word wisdom keepers. For these people, people who keep the wisdom, but also share the wisdom. And I could not have imagined, because I left Geographic not too long after that to write the book, with Steve and I put out the book Wisdom Keepers, which has just been republished by Simon & Schuster just this last year. And, here I'm losing track of it.
Well, it sounds like you went to do a story which had, if I may say so, a bit of a formulaic quality to it.
Oh, yeah.
A story about the medicine men.
Exactly. And we came back with a different story,
you
something
came back
called
with a different
spiritual
story.
Men. What's more, we saw, like Frank Fool's Crow, just pray an eagle out of the sky. We watched it.
Yeah.
Is that a miracle? Maybe that's not as good as parting the Red Sea, but that's a miracle to me when a man prays for a sign from Creator. Give us a sign to tell us you remember your children. Here. And 2 minutes later, an eagle flies right down over us,
circles
over this empty, enormous South Dakota sky in the distance, circled by mountains, and bang, there is this eagle flying over above, and everybody was gasping. People nudged me, you know, at their elbows. Look up there. Now you know the power of wounded knee. So I started getting into the spiritual and affected by the spirituality and the spiritual view and attitudes of these people. The Lakota, certainly, you know, by white man's standard, a classic tribe, right? Northern plains on horses with feathers flying. But I found I was meeting the most wondrous people that I've ever, individuals. I mean, over coffee tables. This was not, you know, these reservations are, you know, if you've never been to one, astonishing. In the poverty and all the stuff that's going on. And yet if you can look a little bit beyond that, beyond the drunks in the doorway, some of the finest human beings on the planet Earth. I could not have imagined that pursuing this, because Steve and I, actually Geographic, killed that story because I was talking about eagles and they said, you're getting
formula?
A little messed up. You know, Harvey, they said that you've gotten in bed with your subject. Standard thing in journalism. Don't get in bed with, in other words, don't take their point of view. You're supposed to be objective. I have not been objective since. At least white man's objective. I am white. I'm not Indian. I'm not going to be Indian. but a much, much enriched life, having traveled among them for nearly 30 years now.
It's funny that they had that attitude, because in anthropology there's been a movement away from that kind of objective, you know, study the natives from afar,
to
a more participatory kind of academia.
There are the anthros, right? I mean, the natives hate these people. They come in and study you like you're a lizard or something. Now, these days, they steal your genetic structure. Take a little swab from your mouth, and all of a sudden, your genetic structure is owned by somebody in Germany or something. This crazy world we live in. Indians are very frightened by all the genetic stuff. But I want to get back to Peltier.
Yeah, how did this all lead to Peltier?
Yeah, it's very surprising. I didn't think in going out, because finally we went out on a whole book to do this for Beyond Words publisher back in Oregon at that time. Though now it's Simon & Schuster publishing it. And I would not have thought going out seeking out these high spiritual people would have let me into Leavenworth Prison. But in those days, the book Wisdom Keepers came out, I used to donate boxes of them, because I live in Washington, D.C., to various Peltier events, which are put on periodically, once or twice a year, maybe at most. And I was out at the mall for a Peltier event. And so I had gotten in, knowing them a little bit. I knew the Peltier story. He was mentioned in a book, and I sent him a book many years ago in which he was mentioned, in a book called Noble Red Man. I may have shown you a copy. It's a wonderful, almost like a native scripture. And I was talking to a guy in the mall who was with the Peltier Committee, and says, has Leonard ever written a book? And he said, we tried and shook, and he wasn't informed. He says, why don't you write Leonard a letter? And I had just finished my book, Dream Keepers, about Australian Aboriginal people. And was like, yeah, I'm a writer, you know, a journalist. And I was looking for some kind of thing, either to edit it or to write, because I do both. And then it occurred to me, who doesn't know about Leonard Peltier? I mean, he was better known in those days than he is today. You can be sure nobody's been celebrating him much since the new administration is. He's just fodder for their prison mills. Anyway, I wouldn't have thought that it would lead me into Leavenworth. I wrote the letter to Leonard, and he sent back. He says, I remember you sent me the book Noble Red Man, he said. And he says, I've been reading Geographic. I have a subscription to Geographic, and he had been reading all my stories. I had a number of Native American stories in Geographic. And he agreed by letter to let me try. And after some months, I produced, 30, 40 pages based on his own writings, because he has been writing a statement since the 80s, if not even before. And I drove out there with this Ron Lessard, was the LPDC guy I had talked to, and to get a final answer. And we sent this 30 pages ahead for him to read. And by that time, I was starting to realize what kind of a net Leonard was stuck in, and it's a dangerous net. A lot of dangerous people involved in it, and strange types, government, non-government. You never know who you're talking to. Then Ron came to me, and then we went over to the prison, and Ron says, you're going to like what he says. And I walked down the ramp after going through all of these security procedures you do when you visit a prison. And there was Leonard standing in khaki pants and I think a sweatshirt or a T-shirt. And we just spotted each other instantly, and in a big gymnasium, you come down a ramp into a big, looks like a high school gymnasium, except there's no windows or anything, and everywhere there's bars and gratings. There's actually more gratings in prison than there are bars these days. But
So you met for the first time at
the... I met for the first time. This was actually at what they call, they have it twice a year at Leavenworth, a spiritual gathering for native inmates.
Mm-hmm.
There's 70, 80, 90 inmates sitting around the room, and I was forbidden to sit down and have a big talk with Leonard. So I had to see him for a few minutes at a time, but we connected right there. He took me by the shoulders. He said, Harvey, if we're to work together, you have to understand, I did not kill those agents, because it's constant publicity coming out to this day that he did. All fomented like all the other stuff that we read in the newspapers. You know, most of it comes out of the basement of the Pentagon somewhere. Lies, lies, lies work. Lies got us into Iraq. Lies got Leonard Peltier into prison. And why are they so hateful towards him and so vindictive? Because there's a bunch of old retired agents about my age, I just going on 72, who committed so many crimes in that era on behalf of big energy, using the organs of government. And if Leonard is guilty, they're innocent. He killed those agents. He did, and it took away. There were many studies. Frank Church had a committee at that time going. They wanted to find out more about Peltier and what had happened. And when these agents were killed, all investigations stopped. A lot of Indian people think they deliberately used these agents in order to do just what happened, because the Frank Church Commission closed down. I mean, they killed, too, somebody. That was the story. That they killed, and, you know, Leonard was supposed to have gone up with some kind of high-power rifle, which he never even had, as was later proven, and finish off two wounded FBI agents laying there in the dust. It's an entirely false story, invented. You know, when you can lie, you can be very inventive. And if someone walked up and arrested you, hey, you know, Mary Charlotte, we saw you kill two guys yesterday out in the street while you were robbing a group. It's not so easy to get out of that charge.
So, I mean, and this is something that as Leonard Peltier has written in this book, Prison Writings, that you edited, Innocence is the Weakest Defense. One thing that was interesting about this process of your working with Leonard Peltier is that not only did you edit his writings, but you really encouraged him to write new things.
It was tough in those days, because I never was able to just like being a visitor and visit Leonard. I would never give him permission, so I could only see him at these gatherings where we could just talk a little. He could call me, but then that's all monitored and everything. I was scared, you know. I didn't know. You know, I used to hide the manuscript. I would tear up old manuscripts and put them in the neighbor's garbage. I didn't know there's not FBI guys lurking in my... These are all fears, and you do get paranoid.
Yeah.
And some of the paranoia is not paranoia, because some terrible things have been done to a lot of people. Never know when the next one will be.
Have you suffered any repercussions for having worked with
Leonard Peltier? Oh, repercussions I have, but I've never been directly threatened by the FBI. I've been in touch with FBI guys. I've been in touch with the guy who's, you know, must be in his late 60s now, Ed Wood, who spends his life defaming Leonard. Because Leonard's like the scab on the wound of all the hideous things that were done. All the dead Indians that nobody remembers even their names now. And Leonard and a few other guys stood up, and they came down to a property there to defend the elders. They were called by the same elders that I had already worked with, Noble Red Man, Frank Fulscrow. You guys come down here and help us. They're coming by every night and shooting us out. And so Leonard and 15, 20 other people, women, children, set up a little camp on this little property at Oglala, a tiny little place on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And they could at least defend those elders, right? Well, one day, two shiny automobiles come roaring onto the reservation at high speed, allegedly chasing some truck, holding a guy who allegedly had stolen cowboy. It was totally false. They had no even warrant to go on there, but they did. And those two guys wound up dead. Those were FBI agents out of Rapid City. Leonard was pinned with the crime. There was a previous trial where they tried to pin two other guys with the crime.
Does anybody know who did it? I mean, is there...
FBI, call them up. They know. And who does? Leonard doesn't know. I'm sure he has his good ideas at this point. He didn't see it happen. He was around. They only later found out, hey, there's two dead agents out there. And then he said, at the minute they heard that, they figured we're all dead. This is the same ground where in 1890, the 7th Cavalry came in and killed 300 men and women huddling in a crowd in the cold. Bigfoot's people. It's all very involved with history. Leonard was last year voted the most famous Indian in American history, including Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and so forth. Leonard Peltier has become a cause beyond himself. Particularly now, 63, they've just about stolen what life he has. He's not well there in prison.
We're talking to Harvey Arden. And he's going to be performing on Thursday and Saturday at El Museo Cultural on Thursday night at 7 o'clock and at the Rail Yard Performance Center on Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. How well is Leonard Peltier known outside the United States versus here in the United States?
He's much better known in Europe than he is here. You're not going to see stories about him in the newspaper here, rarely. And they're usually on behalf of his enemies. Well, we all know about the press. Leonard, I learned a lot about what was going to happen later just seeing what was happening to Leonard, the innocence. This whole notion of, in Guantanamo, those are not the bad criminals from there. Anybody they could grab, more innocent the better. Who needs to know about them? Leonard, I don't like to call him a canary in a cage. Don't you ever call me a canary. Because in prison language, of course, that's a thing. Some people say Leonard is protecting somebody he knows who did it. But he was hundreds of yards away. In a situation of total chaos. In my understanding, he doesn't even know. There must be 10 guys that are said they killed the agents, or the FBI themselves finished them off. All sorts of crazy stuff. But now, 2008, we're putting on this play.
Now, tell us about this play, because is the work you're doing in Santa Fe an early version of the play?
Well, I'm hoping it'll be the first real world premiere, but there have been some minor productions of it.
Okay.
And the people who did those are not involved with this, but we have a wondrous actor, Doug Foote. He's a Lakota from Standing Rock Reservation, a little bit north of Pine Ridge. He does a mesmerizing performance. When I saw even the smaller groups do this, I'd say it was the proudest moments of my literary life, because I had some literary, they're his words, as I edited them, as I re-edited them, as some other people took them and re-edited them and put on stage, because Leonard is so eloquent. If you read this book, Prison Writings, it's like a scripture. And it's not all about the legal details of this case. It's about being human.
No, it's not at all. It's about being a human being.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I thought was very important to talk about was the subtitle of the book, My Life is a Sundance.
My Life is My Sundance.
My Life is My Sundance. What does that mean? What is the significance of the Sundance?
The Sundance is the central ceremony of the Lakota people. They have 7 original ceremonies, but there's nothing higher than the Sundance, and it's where a man or... I don't know that women can do that. Women get cut. But the men have their chest transfixed originally with eagle claws, these days with skewers. And they'll often be dragging a buffalo skull on that. And they're facing the sun in agony. It's pain. It's about pain. It's about withstanding pain, about turning pain into holiness so you can still act. We're genetically determined. If we're in pain, we get out of there, right? Not necessarily an Indian man has been through the Sundance, and an awful lot of Indians these days go through what was originally a Northern Plains ceremony, exactly as we know it, but many of the different tribes all over the country practice something similar. It may not involve lacerations, but any Lakota man will open his shirt to you and show you these scars, and he's proud of those scars. I watched the guys get the scars. There was never a whimper.
So the Leonard Peltier was a sun dancer in his youth. Do you think that's made him been able to? I mean, I know people who have broken in prison. Prison is designed not to rehabilitate you, but to break you.
Exactly.
Is Leonard Peltier broken? Is he spiritually whole?
The very fact that my life is my sun dance means I am suffering for my people. And I'm proud to be suffering for my people. If I have to die this way in prison, I'm still going to help my people. He's become a great humanitarian, also because of his fame, brings in monies, which then goes, most of it, to the reservations for scholarships, for useful purposes on the red, buying oil for the elders who are starving out there right now.
Well, I mean, it's amazing also that I was reading in this book that he is a, Leonard Peltier himself, does charitable work from his prison cell. He's a foster parent of Guatemalan children. He does health care reform.
He has three or four times in the last 15 years been recommended for the Nobel Peace Prize. I worked on the last time he did that. I think it was 2004. And they take him seriously. We were waiting up to the end that year that some African lady got it, and I was heartbroken because if Leonard could get that recognition, he needs some upsweep of interest. He was better known in the 90s and 80s, and the younger generation, that Leonard Peltier, you can ask an Indian kid, they don't even know who he is. We're hoping that maybe some kind of groundswell of major proportions, which means each of you that are listening here, I mean, it's more... To support him and hope for him or even send an email, that's all wonderful. But each person has to figure out how I can call somebody and raise, maybe you know somebody on a radio station. Listen, Mary Charlotte, this is holy work, bringing this message to people. The play grew up out of a reading manuscript that I made from the book. And as I say, other people came along and you could do... You know, two different people would pick different passages. But when Doug Foote speaks these things in the beautiful context of the stage and the drumming, which just is overpowering at times, it's a transformative experience.
So will he be here this Thursday?
No, he will not. I'm speaking on Doug will not. But we are in rehearsals for the new production, and we do hope to open it in Santa Fe sometime this summer, possibly the fall.
Would you like to read a little bit from the play or from the prison writing school?
I can read. You bet. Yeah, we were just talking about... I mean, there's a lot of prose and a lot of other stuff in here.
We're talking to Harvey Arden, journalist and editor of the book Prison
Writings.
Here's
a section. I'm just... no doubt my name will soon be among the list of our Indian dead. At least I'll have good company. For no finer, kinder, braver, worthier, wiser men and women have ever walked this earth than those who have already died for being Indian. Our dead keep coming at us, a long line of dead, ever growing. I'd like to see a red stone wall on the black stone, like the black stone wall of the Vietnam War Memorial. Yes, right there on the mall in Washington, D.C., and on that red stone wall, pigmented with the living blood of our people. And I'd happily be the first to donate that blood. On that wall would be the names of all the Indians who ever died for being Indian. It'd be hundreds of times longer than the Vietnam Memorial, which commemorates the deaths of fewer than 60,000 brave lost souls. The number of our brave lost souls reaches into the many millions. And every one of them remains unquiet until this day. Yes, the voices of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, of Buddy Lamont and Frank Clearwater, of Joe Stunz, Dallas Thundershield, Wesley Bad Heart Bull, Raymond Yellow Thunder, Bobby Garcia, Anna Mae Aquash, those and so, so many others, their still voices cry out at us and demand to be heard. And that's what our production is about, is to get Leonard's words and his messages and through the wondrous vehicle of theater. And this is going to be here in Santa Fe. What I'm going to be doing is speaking about it. There'll be singers there. One of the singers, Silent Bear, from the play, will be there giving his utterly magnificent song on Peltier. I have it in my head right now, but I'm a lousy hummer, so I won't hum it for you. But it's a good day to die. Peltier. Well, anyway, I think he's being interviewed on your station. Is it today or... Silent Bear is...
On the journey home at 5 o'clock? Is it today or tomorrow? I'm not sure.
Anyway, keep your ears tuned to this station for Silent Bear, because he will actually come on between acts. It's a two-act play, and he will sing this wondrous Peltier's song. Peltier. I can't get it out of my head. It's there right now. It's
and that'll be tomorrow. That'll actually be tomorrow
and
on the journey home. Well, we want to thank you very much for being here. And there's far more to talk about, but we're just about out of time. Harvey Arden, I want to really thank you for coming down at this early hour to the Santa Fe Baking Company and for all the work you've done on behalf of Leonard Peltier.
Well, thank you very much. They can reach Keith at... MyLifeIsMySundance.com if they want further information about the show.
And I'd like to thank Keith Rabin also for helping put all of this together and for all the work he's doing behind the scenes.
He's made immense sacrifices to bring this play to life.
What is that website again?
MyLifeIsMySundance.com.
Harvey Arden is a journalist and author of many books and editor of the writings, the prison writings of Leonard Peltier.
Blessings to all you in Santa Fe.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Oh, by the way, and the performances of Harvey Arden's piece will be on this Thursday, January 31st at 7 o'clock at El Museo Cultural. And the phone number over there is 992-0591. And then on Saturday, February 2nd at 7 o'clock at the Rail Yard Performance Center on Paseo de Peralta here in Santa Fe, 982-8309. Yes, you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can hear the station 24 hours a day. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Of those two options, email is a whole lot better. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want. All the past shows are archived about a year back. All this thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thank you to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Adios.